All right, Erev Tov, everybody. It's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Aaron Greenberg, making his debut on Zoom for Torah Motion. He's spoken in the past, some of our live programs, and it's a pleasure to welcome him. Rabbi Greenberg, as for those of you who are listening into our pre-class conversation, he figured out is the head of JLIC, the OU program here in Toronto, which I mentioned earlier today, that's a little bit different than other campuses because here it's basically people live at home. So he's you cover at least three campuses, right, Rabbi?
We try.
We try to cover York and U of T and Ryerson, I believe. And both him and his wife, Miriam, been there for many years. He's also a colleague of mine teaching one course at CHAT. And prior to that, he taught for, I think, I don't know, 8-10 years at Or Chaim, where he's a graduate from. He learned in Yeshivat HaRetzion. He's a graduate of York University with a degree in psychology and religious studies. And it's a pleasure to welcome here him on Zoom. So, Vakasha, Rabbi Greenberg, it's all yours.
Thank you so much, Rory Kelman. Thank you. Appreciate the invitation. And a pleasure to see so many people coming out on a 8:30. It's a lot of people who are coming out to learn Torah. It's quite amazing. I realize maybe it's a little bit easier. You don't have to get into your car and drive somewhere, but still, you have to at least turn on a computer or a phone. So there's a little bit of commitment, which is wonderful to see. And I know there's been a tremendous plethora of classes. I get all the emails in Shurim, there's like really a tremendous amount of offering that Torah in Motion has. Whereas I think certain, Jewish organization diminished. Maybe their Torah teaching, I think Torah in Motion did the exact opposite and doubled up, if not more than doubled, tripled up over the last couple of years. So I think that
I would say quintupled up or octopus up, whatever.
Really?
Whatever.
Really?
Yeah. Okay.
You're saying 800%.
Well, in terms of classes, yes. I mean, we've changed, we stopped our trips. We stopped our Shabbos Scholar in Residence program. But in terms of this, so it's okay. Anyways. Go, we're here to hear part.
You're just saying you'll be able to do both. I'm sharing a screen. Everyone can see it. That's good. Thumbs up. Excellent. Okay. So this is we are in the midst. I don't know if you're coming from Israel, so it's like a repeat. But for those of you that are living here in North America and been here the last number of weeks, we're going to read a very, very difficult parsha this week. It's very difficult. And there's really so much to talk about. And I was debating exactly what aspect to try and highlight. So I'm going to try and touch on a couple of what I think are quite fundamental ideas and concepts, and we'll see where we go. I think it's important not to be too scripted, but to kind of develop as we progress. The first question, and that's the title here, and I wrote the title specifically, Miraglim, I call them spies, which is not in of itself is not a very simple translation, meaning it's a translation of Miraglim. We'll see exactly what the text actually says in a few moments. But really, you're going to see there's going to be a tremendous reaction from God. There's going to be a tremendous reaction from Bnei Yisrael, from the Jewish people themselves. And the question is, was it fair? And in order, I think, to appreciate all that, we have to provide a little bit of context. So let me show you. This is there you go. What's the real story? I realize the graphic doesn't have tremendous resolution, but it's okay. It gets the point. You see the picture over there. And the best way to begin this conversation is to read the text itself. And so I'm not taking any credit for the translation. It literally is a copy paste with minimal editing from Safaria. So if you're not happy with the translation or whatever, I'm sorry, I can't be blamed and I can't take any of the credit. But what I want to do is I want to actually begin. I just want to read the beginning of the text. And, we're a big group, but we're not such a big group. And if you want to throw out a question, I'm okay with that. I know there's like rules and everything, but if you want to put it in the chat, I will definitely try and read the chat as best as I can as we progress. That's the advantage of having more than one screen. I can kind of watch two things at once. But I'm going to read the text, and if I throw out a question, if I say something, feel free again to messages. Yeah, don't worry about that. We'll get there. It's intentional. That's the beauty of having control of the text. I can show you what I want to show you and not show you what I don't want to show you. Although Rabbi Kelman did send a link to the entire thing in a PDF form. If you want to take a look at the chat, you can access it there too. But here, because I can have greater control over the screen, I can kind of highlight certain things, and I will take full advantage of technology in that regard. Rabbi Kelman knows, I have a teacher, a good friend, Rabbi Menachem Liptag. He actually only gives up the source sheets like 20 minutes into his presentation because it can often be distracting and people look at it. First he presents, but I'm not Rabbi Liptag, so I'm just going to go right away to the sources. So here we go. What the text says as follows. Shlach lecha anashim, send agents. And you'll see already when I did this intentionally, by the way. I did not edit translation. Because you'll notice that already, for those of you that are familiar with Hebrew, there's a very interesting translation in English. You can learn a lot from the translation in English, which is why I wanted to keep it. Those of you, basic Hebrew, it's not a very difficult word. If I had to ask you to translate the word anashim into English, how would you translate the word anashim? Answer is?
People.
People, right? People. It could be males, not necessarily, right? Not necessarily. It could be people. Yet when you look at the English, already the English is kind of forced into a type of translation that says send agents. Now, if you had to come up in Hebrew with a word for an agent, what word might you use instead?
Shlichim.
Shlichim, okay, very good. A shaliach is often known as an agent. Very good.
Natsig.
A natsig, right? A natsig, excellent. Another nitzigim. Shlach lecha nitzigim. Shlach lecha, right? So interesting. But that's not the word the Torah uses. So I think we have to highlight that. Again, I intentionally did not want to edit English translation because it's a lot more fun that way. Yeah, right? It's enjoyable sometimes. See what they say. And now look at the next word. Vayaturu et Eretz Kenan. You'll notice English here uses the word scout. Now, the word vayaturu, this is a little bit harder. This is not basic Hebrew over here. The word vayaturu, if you have to translate that into English, what else might you use?
Tour.
Very good. By the way, the English, very helpful over there, right? Tour. T-O-U-R, to tour, tour guide, right? Tour guide. Good, that could definitely be a translation. But interesting how here the English chose it, the word scout. Maybe we'll come back to that a little bit later. Let's continue reading for now. And what is the directive over here? To go do this, where to Eretz Kanan? Asher ani notem l'bnei Yisrael, that I'm giving the Jewish people, ish achad l'matev otav tishlachu, Ko Nasi Behem. And who exactly is going out? Who is heading out for this mission? It is going to be one individual per tribe. And you see the word Tishlachu from the word agent, which, by the way, maybe is the reason why this English translation is using the word agent, because you see the word Shaliach later on come up. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe I totally made that up. I have absolutely no idea. It also is Ko Nasi Behem, meaning we're not sending like the second grade individuals over here. We're not sending, you know, the low class. We're sending the Nasi. We're sending, look at the English translation, the chieftain, the prince, the representative, right? These are individuals of caliber, right? These are people who are very important. So, and we see even here in the great comments that people are saying, right? You know, that the word latour isn't necessarily the word tour to visit, right? Well again, hopefully, right? We will hopefully revisit that a little bit later on. So already in this first pasuk, it's very, you know, you see here that the question is, what's the charge? What's the energy? And we know, depending on how you're going to view these individuals, is going to have a major impact into understanding the narrative, right? What's their job? What's their responsibility? Why were they sent? And that's going to be of very, very much play an important role in understanding what happens. Because how can we analyze anything if we don't understand the context of what in fact is going on? So already that first pasuk almost lays out, that first verse almost lays out or attempts to lay out what's going on, and it's latent in ambiguity. It is unclear exactly what is going on. And the English itself, that's what they wanted to highlight to you, itself struggles over the language, right? You have this word, ve'aturu, which is a strange word to use, right? The word anashim. And what do you mean shlach lecha? Just say shlach, right? What do you mean shlach lecha? Reminiscent of another word that we're familiar with, perhaps, a parsha called lech lecha, right? Also a very odd usage that, in fact, in the, those who are familiar with the Hasidic writing, the word lech lecha in the Hasidic world is saying, you know, go for you, for your good, right? Rashi even brings it down and develops it. But this idea, you know, who's it for? It's for you, for your benefit. So what exactly would that play a role in this verse? Also is quite unclear as well. But that's really important, is that this first verse, the first pasuk, is very ambiguous, which I believe is even somewhat intentional. Okay, let's continue. So the Torah then continues this description of what's going on in this narrative, and it says, "Vayishlach otam Moshe mibar Paran al pi Hashem kulam anashim rashi bnei Yisrael hem," and they are being sent, right? Based on God's command, right? God is saying, go for it, right? Again, the location, Al Pi Hashem, right? I signed off, God signs off on this mission. Kulam and Hashem. Again, the Torah is emphasizing these are important individuals, esteemed individuals, the head of their tribes, the head of the Rashi Benis, or the leaders of their community. Okay. And the Torah continues. What exactly, what are they doing? So here's what the Torah tells us. Vayishlach otam Moshe latur et Eretz Kanaan. Once again, and Vayishlach otam Moshe sends them to, and I'll use the English translation just because it's here, to scout the land of Canaan. And what does he tell them? Alu zebanegev alitem et ahar. Go to the south. Go ascend into the hill country. Uritem et ha'aretz mahi, go see the land, exactly what type it is. The am, the nation, the people that live there, are they chazak, are they strong? Or are they refer, are they weak? Are they ma'at, are they many? Or are they a few, are they rav, are they many? The next one is, uma'aretz, asher yashev ba, hatovahi ra'ah. What about the land? Is it a good land or a bad land? What about the cities that they're dwelling in? Habimichanim imitzarim. Are they open or are they fortified? One more verse before we pause. Uma aretz ashmeinagi imraza. Is the soil, is it rich or poor? Hayeshba eitzim ayin. Is it considered wooded or not? Vehitchazaktem ukachtem mipri haaretz. And just want to scroll over. And take the effort, put effort into bringing back some of the fruit. Vayamin may be kreinavim. It happens to be the time of the beginning of the grape season. Okay. My question is, what is their mission? What are they asked to accomplish? What are they asked to accomplish? If you want to put it in the chat, oops, what happened to the chat? It disappeared. I got to bring that up again. But what exactly are they being asked to do? Give me 1 second. Something happened here to my chat. I don't know what happened to my chat. All right. There it is. Perfect. Okay. So we see here that someone wrote, I think that everyone can see it, to describe the land and its inhabitants, meaning what is the lay of the land. So, is this a military operation? Would you say this is a military operation? Does this sound like a military operation? So do we know of another military, right? Someone said it could be. Do we know of another military operation that took place in the Torah? Anyone familiar? Right, very good. Joshua, excellent, right? We know that when Joshua sends spies, his spies are very different, right? What spies does he send? How many spies does he send? Anybody know?
No.
Two. Right? Two spies. By the way, anyone know their names? Anyone know the names of the spies? Unknown spies. You know why? Because they're spies. You're not supposed to give the names of spies, right? Who's the head of the Mossad? No idea, right? You're not supposed to know. They're spies. This does not seem like a military mission. Not only that, but think about it. Yoshua, they look at one city, Yericho, the next, you know, military target. And later on, the Torah, Moshe is also going to send spies. So we don't really know their names. So this does not seem like a military mission. And as someone here says, it's almost like a PR mission. And which is not right, a PR mission. Now, here's my question. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is it a good thing to send out these individuals, or is it not a good thing to send out these individuals? I understand it's a military exercise. You got to understand, to be successful militarily, you have to know what the enemy is like. But what about here? What then? Why does that matter at all? Why is it important to send the spies? Again, if it's a military mission, I understand. But this is not it doesn't seem like a military mission at all. So why are you sending spies for? Or what? Maybe not spies. Why are you sending these representatives of the tribes for? What function might it be serving? Right. We see someone here says, thank you very much. I appreciate the participation, by the way. Thank you. I want a special shout out to everybody. To whet the appetite of the people for the land, which didn't work. Right. To appease the people, okay, the men were of importance. So it's a very strange thing why you need to send out people in advance of something which is not military. Persuade them to go. Do we see that they don't want to go? Do we see that? Meaning, if right now, if we to pause the moment. So I understand we haven't had a great, the previous parsha wasn't such a great parsha last week. Right, where there's no question about it. You have people who seem to question what are we doing and where are we going, and perhaps let's continue to turn back. So, by the way, the whole idea, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, there's a whole divide over is this a good thing or a negative thing to send these, and I'm going to call them what the Torah calls them, at least here, Anashim, these individuals, to go. Is it a good thing or a negative thing? We're going to see that the commentaries are very split on this. Some say it's a terrible, horrible thing. In fact, Moshe even says that later on in Devarim, in Deuteronomy, when he recounts this episode, he doesn't seem to spin it in a very positive light. He was almost like forced into it, like the crowd influenced him and he did it begrudgingly. Others say, what do you mean? Look at the language here. It's all P-Hashem. God signed off on this mission. How could it not be a good thing? It seems to be quite positive in the beginning. Regardless, I do think that we have to understand what is the function of these individuals. It doesn't appear to be military, but it's something about the land of Israel. Something about the land of Israel. It was necessary to go and have the representatives check out that land. I'm going to tell you a phenomenal insight that Rav Soloveitchik says. Rav Soloveitchik has a beautiful insight. I will not be able to say it nearly as eloquently as he did. Soloveitchik said, do you know why you had to send out the representatives of the tribes? There's a, and this is very Rav Soloveitchik, he takes a halachic concept, something based on Jewish law, and uses it for a sense of, an allegory that is quite profound. And he says as follows. He says, there's a rule that you're not allowed to betroth a lady. A man is not allowed to be mekadesh and isha, asur lekadesh isha ad shirena. You're not allowed to betroth a lady unless you see her. I know that might sound shocking for some of you, like, of course you have to see the lady, but okay, different times, different societies, different cultures. But you're not allowed to betroth somebody. You can't get halachically engaged unless you actually meet her. It explains Rav Soloveitchik. You have to understand the relationship that the Jewish people have with the land of Israel. It's like a groom and a bride. It's like a chatan and Kala. These 12 Shvatim, their job, their mission was to go and check out the land, the beauty, the splendor of the land, report back. Why? In order to, and I think even someone even made reference to this, in order to bring back this report and to show the people what they are going to literally fall in love with. What they are going to, and we know, we see, everyone read the beautiful poetry of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi describing the land of Israel, right? The beauty of the land of Israel, right? The rocks and the stones and the grass, right? Rav Kook, you know, would kiss the land of Israel, and the rabbis, those that study the Talmud and Ketubot, they talk about kissing the land of Israel. It's almost like it's this, it takes this persona, this personality of a human being. It personifies the land of Israel, right? The beauty that she has, describing her as this, as a beautiful woman. So explains Rav Soloveitchik, that's the relationship that we have. And therefore, we needed to. And he says this is actually a positive thing. Sending these individuals was not negative. It's not negative in the sense that we need to understand, we, the Jewish people, need to understand what we're getting ourselves into. We can't go in blindly because it's like a groom and a bride. Beautiful. It's a beautiful idea from Rav Soloveitchik. Regardless, it's clear that this is about the land and the beauty of the land of Israel. I think that's going to help us. Let's continue reading for in the text. Okay. Let's pick up the pace a little bit. Yeah. So I see here someone wrote, these are leaders to influence the people and persuade them to go. So it could be that, especially based on what we read last week, which I'm not going to show right now, but it could be after last week, there is a sense of where are we going? Should we really be heading to the land of Israel? Right? We see this, that the people want to, in fact, maybe it's better to die in the desert. Maybe it's better to return back to the land of Israel. And therefore, they needed that sense of encouragement from their leaders, from the heads of their tribes, from the Nisim themselves, for sure. Okay, the Torah continues. I'm going to put I think my mouse is there. People can also follow along. But yeah, Shuvim Yitro, again, after 40 days, they report back. By the way, when spies report back to Yeshua, who do they report to? Yeshua. When you report back, you know, I can't say I can speak from personal knowledge, but I imagine in the Mossad, or the FBI, or couldn't even tell the Canadian counterpart, the Mounties, or I don't know, whatever it is, right? When they report back, they are not reporting back to the entire people. You report back, if it's a military mission, to the military leader, whoever that, you know, MI6. I don't even know if that's a joke or if that's Syria. Yeah, CSIS. There we go. Yeah, I think that's probably it too. But regardless, that the idea is you don't report back to the nation. What do we know about military strategy? Gornish, nothing. But you speak to the person who's the head of who's, you know, mission control. But we see here the people, these 12 individuals are reporting back to the people. Okay. And what, in fact, are they saying? What's the report? Okay. I want to just move on. And they say what happened. Here we go. We're reporting back. And look at the language. We've come back to the land Asher Shelachton. You sent us. We hear the language. And that, by the way, is why I'm fairly certain the English translation like the language of agents. Because you'll notice the word Shlichut, which is an agent word repeated over and over and over and over again. So that's why they chose that translation. But again, I have no idea. I just made that up. The text goes on to say, okay, we've come back. V'gam zavat chalav udvash. It's flowing with milk and honey, and this is its fruits. I'm going to say something a little bit controversial, which I can do. It's Torah in motion. It's beautiful, right? The word chalav here, although we usually say milk and honey, and the Talmud does talk about the beautiful milk from the cows, and for sure, but it is also very possible that milk here could also mean another type of milk. Not milk from a cow or from a goat, but milk from almond milk. Because think about the context of the verses. We're talking about the land of Israel, right? And by the way, Devash, I should have said this too. Devash here doesn't mean honey from a bee. This is the land of Israel. It's talking about Devash Samarim from dates. Exactly.
From dates.
Right? Date. So again, this is talking about the land of Israel and the beauty. Okay, leave that aside. It's not really that important for now. But again, we will come back. Let's continue. And that's what they do. Now, so far, anything wrong? Are they doing anything? Have they said anything that they weren't supposed to say? So far, not. Let's continue reading. However, the people who inhabit the country are powerful. And the cities are fortified and very large. We saw the Anakites there. And again, the giants, whatever it may be. Anything, anyone see anything in that verse, perhaps, that's something that they weren't supposed to mention, that they weren't asked to report back on? Okay, I assume. No, so there is. Sorry?
No, I think it sounds like they're reporting what they've seen.
Yeah, sounds like what they've seen. And in fact, the vast majority of commentators agree, except for one. One commentator, namely the Ramban, says that this word FS.
The word FS.
How can you say FS? However, alas, that's already subjective. To me, to put the blame on one word is quite is a little bit harsh, but okay, fine. Regardless, it's 98-99% reporting back. And again, the next verse, they're reporting where people are living and dwelling. To me, that's pretty objective. Okay. Whoops, I went too far. To this, however, do a half? I can't scroll a half. I guess not. To this, Kalev says, Vayas Kalev. Isn't that interesting? Vayas Kalev. Kalev hushed the people. Excuse me. Do you see the people made any noise? What is it? What's he silencing the people about? This is the Midrash is beautiful. The Midrash, which is quite the Midrash, which are rabbinic teachings on the rabbis were very in tune to the text. Their ears are very, very sensitive, very, very sensitive. And to this, we see that the rabbis say, yes, you need to shush the people because the people heard the word. The people heard Amalek.
Amalek.
Amalek, that doesn't sound very good. The nation that gave a lot of trouble, the Jewish people, right? That's very problem. And over they got scared and they were murmuring. Others say that he picked up already that the, you know, when you use the language of that the people are strong. They're fortified, right? Well, that being said, some people say if it's not fortified, it shows that you're actually stronger because you have more confidence. Regardless, right? You see these the Anakites, which are understood by many to be giants. So perhaps the people were beginning to panic and get scared. And so Kalev shushes them. Others say Kalev is actually is trying to, he realized where this potentially might be going. And so what he's doing here actually is, do you know what else? Do you know what else Moshe did? And he adds in, he also did all these wonderful miracles, meaning it's clearly that Kalev is responding to something that's going on. Again, what it is definitely unclear. Let's continue reading for now. He silences the crowd and he says, no, alo na'alev yarashnu ota ki achon nuchala. We can do it. We can go up. We can possess it. So clearly it seems he's responding to the people who are very reluctant. And I even saw a few comments a little bit earlier. The people were scared. The people were reluctant. And either they were reluctant, maybe not even because of this report, but they were reluctant based on last week's Parsha, the Torah portion that we read just a few days ago. And or maybe he sees where this is going. Or maybe he heard the other people. It comes across as spies. We're so used to that type of language, right? And therefore, he knew what was going to come. Or he hears these words and he sees the panic. It's clear that he realizes there's something that this is not going to go in the right direction. And he is correct. Because in the very next verse, Vanashim Asher Aluimo, the other people that went with him said, Lo nuchal la'alot ela'am. We can't do it. We can't attack. We cannot be victorious. Ki chazak hu imenu. For it is stronger than we. And the rabbis actually pick up the word mimenu. Maybe he's even referring to God, right? So they say, we can't do it. They're stronger than us. We are not going to be militarily victorious. We're going to fail. And in the next verse, Vayetzu dibat ha'aretz asher taru ota b'nei Yisrael le'mar, aretz asher varnu v'ala tura te'aretz achal d'shvei, kol ha'amashirinu b'tochan shimidon. And there's something about this land, eretz achal yoshvei, it devours its inhabitants and everyone there who are considered anshei midot, probably referring to people who are quite strong, which, by the way, is an inherent contradiction. The land and devours its people, how could the people there be quite strong? But again, this isn't necessarily a rational thing. And we see all of a sudden now, this report back goes from bad to worse. Rasham ra'inu nefilim b'ne'anak, m'ne'anak m'ne nefilim. We saw the Nephilim there. We see these giants, and we look like grasshoppers. We were teeny tiny. We looked at grasshoppers to ourselves, and so we must have looked to them. My friends, this is quite a dangerous type of a language, because now we see something, especially in the second half. We see the report where these individuals are saying, very dangerous, dangerous words. We will not be successful. Who asked you were going to be successful? Were you asked about anything militarily? Leave the military up to God. God has shown a pretty good track record over the last, remember, we are stationed right now about 14 months. How I got that calculation, message me, I'll explain it later. About 14 months after we left Mitzrayim. Right? 50 months after we left Mitzrayim. So, last week Parsha was Pesach Sheni, right? So that was the middle of ER. So we're, 13 months plus a little bit into the 14th month. There you go. I explained it. And if that's true, God has a pretty good track record over the last few months. He's provided a great deal to the Jewish people. And you're questioning his military prowess? You're saying that God's not going to be successful? Or we're not going to be successful? That already is a very jarring comment, especially if you take a look at this last line, that we look like grasshoppers, right? We look like grasshoppers. How do you know what they thought of us, right? How do you, you're making an assumption. You're putting yourself in the local inhabitants and how they viewed us. They viewed us like grasshoppers, like nothing. They would be squashed in a second. They saw themselves as little, as small. And that, my friends, is quite dangerous. Quite dangerous. Okay. And then they cry. Famous line, Vatisal Kol Adav Atumet Kolam Vayivku Ha'am Balai Lahu. And the rabbis tell us this was the night of Tisha B'Av. So there was a gap. So last week's Parsha was the episode of Pesach Sheni. This is already, according to tradition, a couple months later. That's about the 14 months, whatever, 15 months after the exodus from Egypt. Okay. So, a land that eats its inhabitants. Aha. Uh-huh. Oh, that only the strong survive. I don't know who iPad is, but yes, that only the strong survive and the weak die out like Sparta. Sparta, those of you that are not familiar, they would chuck babies off of cliffs who were born with various physical defects and left to die. And so only the strong people can survive. Thank you. Yes, that is what it's referring to. Thank you. Again, the text goes on to say that the people cried and they were distraught and they was hopeless. And that's exactly what they said. They went to Moshe, they went to Aaron. And what did they say? You took us here to die. Why'd you bring us here? We're essentially going to be wiped out. We're going to have military. It's going to be a disaster. We're going to be slaughtered in front of our wives and our children. Right? Let's go back and return to Egypt. Okay. And that's what they said. Let's go back and let's return to Egypt. And we know what is God's response. I'm just going to fast forward for a second. What is God's response? Oh, sorry. First of all, let's talk about... So this is actually Kalev who's speaking over here. Kalev says, no, we can do it. It's a good land. So this is Zavar Chalav Udvash. Don't rebel against God. Right? Don't have fear of them. God is with us. And you'll even notice, I'm just going to highlight here that if you take a look at the bottom line where my cursor is, we're going to see that Moshe turns to God and almost says, it's kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. So this is essentially the end. This generation, the people here, that for whatever reason, they don't believe in themselves, don't have confidence in themselves, they don't have confidence in God, and therefore we cannot move to the land of Israel. And it seems as it is their portrayal and understanding of themselves, the lack of confidence in both themselves and in God, that is their ultimate rebellion, not believing in God's ability and not believing in their own ability to be successful in the land of Israel, that in many ways leads to their demise. And this is not the first time, as it says here, Eser Pa'amim V'lo Shemu B'Kali. For many, many times, they have disobeyed Moshe, they disobeyed God. Now, we know, I'll just finish this off, for every day that they traveled, they received a year in the desert. And in fact, we know that it was essentially the idea of spending 40 years in the desert until this generation dies out and the next generation can enter the land of Israel. Okay, so that's essentially what the text tells us. But here's something quite interesting. If you had to look at Sefer Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, and is this primarily a book where we see narrative or where we see laws, mitzvot? Which one do you think Bamidbar kind of emphasizes a little bit more? Narrative or mitzvot?
Narrative.
Narrative. Yeah, thank you. This seems to be very much a narrative, you know. There's a story. We're marching. We're preparing our camp to move forward to the land of Israel and our numbers. And we're heading definitely in that direction. So the question we have to ask ourselves, and I think this is quite important, is, and I could have asked this, by the way, a couple weeks ago. It's very obvious in Parshat Naso, which we read a couple weeks ago, where all of a sudden you have the laws of the Sota, the wayward woman. You have the laws of the Nazir, a man or a woman who takes on various laws. Why are they mentioned in what seems to be a narrative text? And so, too, you find at the end of our Torah portion a whole bunch of laws that literally seem to come from left field. Left field. They're almost like, what are they doing? If I were to cut and paste them, I could have pasted them in many different locations. No one would have batted an eyelash. Cut and paste. Because, and by the way, they weren't even mentioned now. We know all of the mitzvot were given at Sinai, right? Avraham Moab, some were given Avraham Moab, which is much later. They were given at Sinai. They were given in Ol Moed. They were not given now. They were given earlier, over the last year, year and a bit. So why are they recorded? Why did the Torah choose to record them now at the end, in our case, and the aftermath of the episode of the Meraglim? And this is a very, very important question. It's a complicated question. I'll see how much time I have to deal with this properly. I'm going to deal with the one that is the most obvious first, because that I will have time to deal with. And it's also the most popular and well-known. And it'll help fit a little bit easier with a certain theme. In fact, the last mitzvah that many of us are familiar with is what we call the mitzvah of tzitzit. And again, I didn't include all the verses, just a couple. Torah tells us at the end of our parsha, the end of our Torah portion, the bear of Bnei Yisrael, that's where my cursor is, from our Torah, lehem vasu lehem tzitzit. We have to take these tzitzit, these fringes, al kanfei vigdehem ledoratam, v'natnu al tzitzit akanaf petot chelet. So again, just make sure, in case people are not familiar, we take a four-corner garment. A four-corner garment, we affix to it these strings, and we attach these strings, and also a blue string as well, bluish string as well, referred to as tchelet, which there's been a resurgence of over the last couple of decades, according to some. But what's interesting is why did the Torah choose to record this mitzvah of tzitzit now? Why? It's like, I mean, it's a nice mitzvah, don't get me wrong, it's a beautiful thing, but why are you including it now? And so I think we have to read the verses very carefully. It says as follows, Vayalachem letzitzit, uritem oto, and you will see them, uzechartem et kol mitzvot Hashem, and you will recall all the commandments of God, vasitem otam, and you'll fulfill them. Velo taturu achare levavchem v'achare yinichem asher atem zonim achareihem. Look at the commandments, observe them, and you do not follow your heart and eyes in your various urges. Well, isn't that interesting? We see, the Torah tells us, that the function of tzitzit is to remind us of, shall we say, staying on the path. And when someone wrote this correctly, Velo taturu. Isn't that interesting? How, perhaps you will recall, earlier on, Bnei Yisrael, sent these anashim to tour, right? Mitur aretz, once. How many times does it say this word? Once. Go back a little bit. It says it again over here. There you go. Vayaturu. But that was a mission. Remember how we started with this? Isn't that interesting that the English here chose the word scout? Well, I don't think the word, it means to scout. Over here when it comes to tzitzit, or itemotam, velo tatura acharei levavchem, and you shouldn't, I don't know, scout? I'm not so sure. Right? And the repetition of the phrase uritem, right? Because it says uret aretz mahi, and you'll see the land, what it is, right? So seeing, by the way, this is a very powerful idea. When you see something, your heart can be persuaded. And the question is, when you see something, what does it remind you of? How does it impact you? What effect does it have? So we have 10 people. And by the way, we could have an entire conversation, which obviously we do not have time for. But there's another time in the Torah where 10 people went to look for something and to bring back a report that was negative that led to a tremendous amount of mourning. I'm referring to the Joseph story, right? And by the way, it's interesting because Ephraim and Yeshua come from the tribes of Yehuda and come from the tribe of Yosef, right? Ephraim's son. So there's a tremendous amount of overlap also when it comes to that story, which again rips apart the Jewish people, sends them in a very difficult trajectory, right? Clearly it's connected to this story narrative as well, which we don't have time to analyze. But nonetheless, I think there's a lot to talk about. We see from here that
also the word Diba,
right? That both cases is Diba Ra'ah, that the brothers brought a Diba Ra'ah about Yosef, and here too. Yes. In fact, many more connections, but thank you. When we talk about the function of tzitzit, velo taturu, so maybe the question is going to be, when you see something, how do you respond? When you see something, how does that impact you? When you see something, how are you supposed to interpret it? We know there's a tremendous amount of subjectivity in the world. We live in a subjective world. Yes, there's black and there's white for sure. Color is subjective. It's color. It's one of the most superficial things that exists is color, right? Black or white, blue or red. There's, you know, although, you know, my kids sometimes mention colors that, you know, magenta and like skylight blue. Like I don't really understand these things so well. But, you know, there's like, you know, different types of blue. There's blue. I always grew up with blue, you know, a couple types of blue. There's so many different shades of blue. It's an amazing thing, the world that we live in. But that's color. But how do you interpret events? When you see something which is challenging, what's your response? And so the function of tzitzit is to remind you who's in charge. Whose world are we living in? And the rabbis tell us the function, at least of the tchelet, of the blue, is to remind you ultimately through various stages of Hashem, of God himself. And sometimes we forget. We live in a world, we need symbolism. We need things to remind ourselves of what are we doing here? What's our function? Who do we work for? We work for God. How are we supposed to interpret things that are around us? And that's why if you take a look, the rabbis say that why did the Anashim, the quote unquote spies, reach an erroneous conclusion? Because wherever they were, people were dying. There were all these funerals. Oh, funerals everywhere. What a terrible land. You could interpret it that way. You could interpret it like the weak die out and all that's left are strong. Or as the rabbis, I think, were suggesting God was behind everything, trying to help them, that they wouldn't get caught or trapped. They could actually see what's going on in the land. The people wouldn't start asking them questions of what are you doing here? And, you know, being and having other people become suspicious. But how do we interpret events that we see in front of us? How do we interpret, yes, there's Amalek. Yes, the people might be, all those things could be true. In fact, they probably are true. They're reporting the facts. But we all know, especially in the world that we live in, what do you do with those facts? How do you take them to? And sometimes it can take us to a very dark and dangerous path. And maybe the Torah is trying to tell us the antidote, a way, could be with this idea of these tzitzit. That's what I have those eyes over there, right? And that's, and again, when you see something, how does that impact you? Anyone, and by the way, again, lots of parallels in the Gan Eden story, the Garden of Eden also. We know that when you see something, right, it's a world, the tree was a tree of good and evil, of Tovara. And in many ways, this land of Israel, is it a good land or is it a Ra or is it an evil land, right? And that's also something which leads to often to a sense of subjectivity, which is, and again, how are we supposed to understand when we have all these events literally right in front of us? We also know that the word tetur, latur, appears somewhere else. In fact, in last week's Torah portion as well. It's a little bit less famous. V'yasuru mehar Hashem, der shoshet yamim, v'aron brit Hashem nosel difnehem der shoshet yamim latur lahem menucha. They marched from the mountain of God, a distance of 3 days. The Ark of the Covenant of God traveled in front of them on the three-day journey to seek out a resting place for them. Latur lahem menucha, to seek out. You see, again, the word is used. Latur, same word as we've seen before. So how you translate the word latur, is it to seek out? Is it to scout? Is it to, you're searching your eyes? It's amazing how it's used in all these different situations. But what's interesting is a lot of them are clearly trying to point us into this direction of looking and of seeing. When you scout something out, right? When you're seeking out a resting place, you're looking where you're going to camp. It's your eyes. It is your perception. And the question is, what is the reality that we live in? The Lubavitcher Rebbe actually says something quite interesting. I met earlier today with a number of young men and young women who are actually heading to McMaster University next year. And, you know, and I mentioned to them this idea that I think is also very true. They just finished seminary in yeshiva. What was amazing about seminary yeshiva, those of you that went or didn't go, or know people that went, was that it's very much a bubble in the sense they provide you with everything. You know, food, some places more than others, good food, bad food, subjective, right? What do they say in Hebrew? Tam varech, ein vakeach. So, okay, smell and taste. Can't always argue those things. It's very individualized. But regardless, what happens after a year of seminary in yeshiva, or many years in either one of these places, is what happens when you leave that bubble? How do you respond? And that is the real test of life. Lubavitcher Rebbe said that this generation, who would want to leave living in the bubble in the desert? You had everything you wanted was with you. Everything that you wanted was with you, right? You had food. You know, in the desert, bread fell from the sky. In the land of Israel, bread didn't come from the ground. I live in Thornhill, so we think bread here comes from like Sobeys or Mizades or something, right? That's where bread comes from. We forget the source of food and the source of sustenance. And Lubavitcher Rebbe explained that, you know, they were just, and I think even someone made a comment in the chat about it, it is not easy taking a generation. And even when you're a slave, everything's provided for you. Now, you often have a very much of a perverted sense of what was provided for you. You think it was all that good. Is it really that good? Right? Based on last week's Torah portion, it's hard to imagine that the Egyptians provided them with all those goodies. I find that very hard to believe. But sometimes when you're scared, when you see something in front of you and it impacts your psychological, emotional state, you forget the facts and you begin to be taken over by this fear. You don't want to leave your current situation, right? There are many people that felt very comfortable, right? Over the last couple of years, staying at home, it was safe. It was a sense of, you know, of comfort. And leaving and going out there and going to that next stage, back into the world, can be very challenging. Going back to the land of Israel when you have no experience what it's going to be like. And yes, they're going to have to fight wars. The war that they fought against Amalek, that was a miraculous war. The Torah says Moshe put his hands up in the air and they're victorious. Well, that's not going to happen in the land of Israel. They're going to have to fight a war. They're going to have to work quite hard. And so I think the Lubavitcher Rebbe's understanding is that was their fear factor. Regardless, I do think that the people had this sense of tragic failure in believing in themselves, believing in God. And this was the wrong generation. God felt he needed to hit the reset button, had the next generation perhaps not have that sense of safety and security in the desert, but instead long for and yearn for and face with a sense, hopefully, of an open mind. The land of Israel, its challenges, but it's also its beauty. Life is difficult in the land of Israel, as I'm sure some of you, many of you know. But many things are difficult and challenging. The question is, do you have the confidence both in yourself and God that you can be successful or not? So perhaps those are some ideas and some suggestions of what exactly is going on in our Torah portion this week. Again, a lot more to talk about. But those were some ideas that I wanted to share. I know there's only a few minutes left. I'm happy to respond to questions or thoughts. I'm happy to respond to individuals, happy to everyone to respond to everyone else's comments. If you want to put it in the chat or you want to speak, please feel free to do so.
Not so many people often like to speak, by the way.
I'm aware, I know. That's the chat.
They like the chat box.
They like the chat box. Yeah.
You know,
Rabbi Kelman, remember teaching, over Zoom for the last few years. It's always interesting to see who responds, who talks. Those are students who give higher marks to. I know I do.
Right. Okay.
So that that's the case, which I had concern that would be the case. Let me go back for a minute. I want to show people. What about the rest of the mitzvot that are in our parsha this week? I mentioned the one that's very easy, one that's mentioned that's obvious. The other mitzvot are more complicated. So if I have, I can take 5 more minutes. Is that okay, right, Kelvin? Yeah, okay, fine.
Absolutely, yes. Fine.
Okay, good.
I think challah is one of the mitzvot.
Yes, it is. Okay, so these are, what I did was, I edited. These are not the entire text. I just kind of took one or two verses from each one of these mitzvah just to give a taste of what they are. So the first one is what we call nisachim, that when we bring a korban, we have to offer libations. The yayin lenesach, again, and this is the amount that we pour over it. Now, first of all, why in the world would this be included now? We should have taken this, cut, and paste it somewhere in Leviticus. There's like four other places you could have added this, and it would have been a lot, shall we say, smoother of a transition. Why specifically is it mentioned here? And again, in the aftermath of what's referred to as Chet Meraglim, the sin of the spies. So maybe, again, yeah.
Maybe because they mentioned Bikurei Anavim.
Okay.
And to give them hope that they'll get there and they'll use the Anavim for it.
Okay. When the Torah pointed what seemed to be an innocuous statement that is pretty much, well, it seems to be relevant. V'hayamim yemei b'kurei navim, I believe is the quote. And these are the times of b'kurei navim. Like, that's nice. Why is it relevant? So first of all, it could be that it's the beginning. One, I don't remember exactly who says this, but the fact that it's the beginning of the season and they brought back, remember that picture that I showed you? That's quite a famous picture, right? They're holding, right, these big grapes, right? Well, that's the beginning. Imagine what they're going to look like in a couple months from now, right? So again, that's part of the Shavach of the land of Israel, for sure. By the way, Bikurei, the root word of Bikurei is Bechor, which means first, right? First choice is first. Which, again, the message of first and Bechor plays a very large role in the Torah itself. But perhaps that what do you do with the grapes? What do you do with the grapes? You offer them, don't look at them as something which necessarily should be used for, you know, just material gain and enjoyment. You can, at least according to the Bavitcher Rebbe, you can uplift them. You could use them as something of kiddushah, something of holiness and of sanctity. Right? That you could even use that physical world of the land of Israel. It's not just that if they're choosing between one world and the other, the quote unquote, the division between that spiritual world, which is the desert, and the physical world of the land of Israel. That we don't have to live in this bipolar, this separate, this world of, you know, of total separation. It's simply not true. You can elevate that physical idea. Those of you that understand the Bavitcher Rebbe, and especially in the world of Chassidut, understand that is definitely true. They don't just look at the land of physical, you uplift that physical world. So that's what you do. You can take your basic food of oil and of wine, and you can uplift them specifically in a with something that has to do with sacrifice. is one way perhaps to understand why they are written here. That's how the Lubavitch Rebbe understood it. You could also say, again, was mentioned before, specifically, it's taking the grapes that they came with and they brought. Okay, then the problem is, what about the oil? I don't have the great answer for, but the grapes I have a little bit of a better answer for. Okay, that's why it's learning. We don't, you know, we have an important question. We've got to figure out exactly what was the oil. But for sure, I think when it comes to the grapes, I do think that's definitely part of it. The other one is, and this
Rabbi, isn't the introduction to that mitzvah is it's kind of a reassurance to Bnei Israel that despite of what you just complained about and the consequence of that, you will be there are mitzvot now that you will be responsible for when you get into the land. So I'm promising you the land is still part of the picture.
Yes, thank you. That was great. So the question is that for me and you? Is that for them? That's also an interesting question, right? Were Bnei Israel aware of those psukim right afterwards? Are they there for us? It's an interesting question, right? When did they get them? But for sure, there's no question that the promise of entering, thank you, that was an important point, that entering the land of Israel is still going to happen. There might be a delay, but the delay is temporary. No question about it. Thank you. And what about Torah Achat and Mishpat Achat Yalachem? We notice that there's a tremendous emphasis on one law, both for the, only have 4 minutes left. So I know we start on time, we have to end on time. That's very important. But again, clearly the idea of one law, it doesn't necessarily matter, you know, the stranger, when you often strangers are seen in a community as different. We perceive them, right? Well, you're different than we are. You have to treat people that you often see as different like everybody else. You can't exclude them from the community. They have to have the same rules apply to me, they apply to you. Having one set of rules for everyone is going to ensure, hopefully, that we're going to have a successful returning back to the land of Israel and building this society. And it emphasizes on a society that we have to build, because an elevated society is one that treats everyone with a sense of dignity. So, okay, there's, again, more to talk about that, because there's also this Mekoshesh Eitzim. Why specifically is Mekoshesh Eitzim mentioned here? The person who does some type of desecration on Shabbat, why is that mentioned here? What does that seemingly have to do with anything? I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there's an excellent article on the virtual Ben Midrash by Gush Etzion specifically. Can't remember at this point in time who wrote it. You can go look it up. Go Google it. You can look up VBM, virtual Ben Midrash. On this Torah portion, I'm sure they connect. It's a great thing. I'm not going to do it justice in like 2 minutes, but it is definitely a fascinating analysis and a conversation. But again, just to conclude, what I think is so important in trying to understand and try to make that the Torah portions are still relevant and meaningful in the lives that we lead today, it's understanding what is our mission, how do we see things in life, how do we interpret things in life. And ultimately, I think it's believing in ourselves, believing in HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help us get through our challenges. It doesn't mean life will be easy, but it'll allow us to take that next step in our own personal futures. So God willing, all of us will be able to, learn these lessons and appreciate the text that we have and the richness to connect in our own personal lives and to see the beauty of the Torah, which connects so many words and ideas. What is it? All the Torah is really one idea. And it connects. We see words here that connects to Yosef and to Gan Eden and to many other themes and messages that are clearly repeated over and over again in the Torah. But I think ultimately will lead to a much greater understanding of us and the world that we live in order to have us progress into the nation that we, God willing, will eventually truly become one day.
Thank you very much. You ended one minute early, Rabbi.
1 minute early.
1 minute early. That's okay. All right. Thank you. You can unshare your screen if you want, just. But thank you very much. Okay. Enjoy. You get a little break in the summer, I hope.
Yeah, it's a little lighter in July.
Okay.
We have our fundraiser, so that's always busy.
All right. Very good. Okay. Tomorrow morning, please go on my share in the Siddur at 9:35 a.m. Bye, Rabbi. Shabbat Shalom. Sunday morning.
Shalom, everybody.
At 11:15. And next Thursday night, Parsha Shir is given by Nechama Price, who runs the GPATCH program at Stern. We'll be giving the shiur next Thursday night. And in between then and now, we have, besides mine and Rabbi Liebtag's shiur, Mark Shapiro will have his last shiur now for the summer before we go on our traveling trips, Italy and Portugal, and Tova Ganzel and Lori Novak and Marty Lakshin and Shuli Mishkin and all our shiurim during the week. We hope to see you, and please invite a friend. And thank you. And we'll keep the emails coming. We'll keep you busy, Rabbi. You know, so
keep up the holy work. Keep up
that's
the
it. Work. We're trying. Okay, very good. Okay, thanks everybody.
Light it up. Appreciate the opportunity.
And Shabbat Shalom. We hope to see everybody soon. Thank you. Bye bye.
Thank you. Have a good night. Thank you.
Good night. Light it up.
Thank you, Yishkaya.